Last week, I spoke to High Rocks athlete and the host of the Rocks Life podcast, Greg Williams. We discussed Greg's training for High Rocks, what mindset and physical quality separate the elite racers from the rest of the pack, and the future and professionalism of High Rocks. If you haven't already, make sure you check out that episode. Hello and welcome to The Progress Theory, where we look to implement scientific principles for optimizing human performance. I am Dr. Phil Price, and on today's episode, we are joined by ex-SAS and now the founder of the Modern Warrior Project, Lindsay Bruce. Now, I've always wondered what it takes to get into the SAS. What does it take to be the 0.1% of the 0.1%? You hear on social media all this about discipline, leadership, being a fast learner, but you can be a fast learner and a disciplined leader, but still not make SAS selection. Is it all about the physical, or is it all about having the right mindset? And also, can we actually learn these physical attributes and these mental skills and actually start to apply them in our everyday lives outside of the military? As always, follow and subscribe to The Progress Theory on Instagram, YouTube, and you can check all of our content out there. Here is Lindsay Bruce. Before we get started, I wanted to mention the Progress Theory newsletter. Do you want the latest information on how to optimize human physical and mental performance sent straight to your email? Subscribe to the free Progress Theory newsletter on Substack, where you will receive the latest research and recommendations on how to optimize your performance each week. Head to the show notes and click the link where you can sign up today. Don't miss out. Now, let's get into the show. Lindsay, how are we? Thank you so much for coming on The Progress Theory.
Pleasure to be here, mate. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I've really been looking forward to this episode because stuff regarding the SAS seems to be getting really, really popular, and it has for a number of years now. It used to be this profession which was kind of shrouded in a bit of mystery, but everyone kind of appreciated what they did. But now people are having a bit more of an understanding of the qualities of the people that are involved, both physical and mental. And I think people want to know a bit more because they appreciate if they actually learnt a little bit of that and applied it in their own setting, like in civilian life, in their own jobs, whatever it might be, you know, that's really going to take them to the next level. So I really wanted to speak to you as someone that was selected for the SAS and had a established career in it to actually truly understand what exactly it takes to be the elite of the elite.
Yeah, I mean, what you just to allude to what you said a minute ago about the popularity of the whole scene of the special forces, not just the UK, but worldwide, I would say, especially when you're linking that from TV to social media and obviously recent years' popularity with the TV shows that has just grown arms and legs, obviously, you know, which is going back to before all this happened, you had the odd thing that would maybe come out that would be popular on TV, but it didn't really go to that level of popularity. And I think social media has obviously helped catapult that into the, you know, another stratosphere, really, which has got positives and negatives along with that. So, I mean, when I was growing up and the whole mystique around the SAS was a thing for me because no one really knew anything about it, even in the military. I remember being back in my old unit because we didn't actually have anyone who had gone to the SAS since the late 70s. So I was essentially the trailblazer in that sense that then opened the doors for a few more to come afterwards. There still wasn't that many, but at the time when I applied for the SAS, the big attraction for me was because no one really knew anything about it. There was this whole sense of mystery and mystique around the whole thing, which I thought was pretty cool. And that's what everyone thought. It was the unknown, right? Venturing into the unknown. So no one knew what to expect. I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know what it was going to entail. There was none of these things that exist these days. So company I worked for at the weekend, they run the fan dance event up in the Brecon Beacons, and they also do like mock events so that someone that's in the military who wants to potentially go and do SAS selection, Special Forces selection, they can go and have a bit of a trial run. And it's kind of like a recreation of the event because the routes are the same, the times are the same, the weights are the same. So they can almost like do a bit of a noisy rehearsal before they go on. So it's a good taster, which is great, right? But then going back to circa 2015, when the popular TV show first came out, and since that, it's just, it's gone like that, you know, and everybody wants to have a bit of this. Everyone wants to experience a piece of what happened. Now, the confusion I always emphasize with that is it's a TV show. It's nothing that represents SAS selection. It's purely just a physically and mentally based, fairly arduous test for civilians to go and do. Right, and it's very, very short and chronological time frame. It's days as opposed to months.
Yeah, it's like 2 weeks, isn't it? The TV program, what?
A couple of weeks. Yeah, I mean, it's a drop in the ocean. It's a test. It's a little test, you know. But that is it. that is really it. It's like a taste of a chicken korma versus eating a whole vindaloo.
Everyone can understand that. Everyone has tasted the exactly, different levels of hotness when it comes to curry.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So could you explain to me how you could potentially apply for the SES? So I'm assuming, you know, me, I'm not in the armed forces, so I can't just go, right, I'm going to go straight for SES selection. I'm sure I've got to work my way up to a certain point to prove that I could potentially even be considered for selection.
And they have, I mean, I'm going to go off what I experienced because in all honesty, the way it works these days, I'm not entirely sure. I'm not privy to all the details of how the selection process, the application process works for that. I've got a rough idea, but I don't think it's changed that much. There have been some screws tightened as far as the procedure to apply. It's actually harder, I think, to get to day one in selection these days. Before I joined, so I applied in 99. And at that time, you had to do what they called a briefing course. The briefing course was like a pre-selection. It was a test before you could go on selection, essentially. Now, before they implemented this briefing course, way back before my time, they didn't have that. So you could essentially just walk up and start selection. Now, the problem with that logistically was you had a lot of people who were completely out of their depth, who just wanted to turn up to say, you know, to have on their resume that they had gone for selection once. So they tried for the SAS, but really the reality is that they turned up on day one and didn't get past the first day. You know, they turned up at Hereford train station or whatever, you know, turned up at Sennybury's training camp and then said, yeah, I was on selection, but, you know, the intention was never to pass. It was always just to say that they had the accolade of, I turned up and, you know, I guess, yeah. It's
gift shop.
Bullshit, right? So then what happened? So you had to essentially pass the briefing course and then be accepted on selection. So that's what I had to do. It was like a three-day event whereby you could, you turn up to Hereford and they put you through a bunch of tests. It was really difficult, actually. You know, they do a lot of theory tests, military theory tests, followed by a load of physical tests in the gym, out in the training area, you know, tabbing with weight on your back. And it was all back-to-back stuff. I always remember it was pretty cheeky little test. But it separates the wheat from the chaff. It gets rid of the people who are completely non-starters. And then you get some of the guys that go on it. It would be a case of, you know, you're not ready yet, but you've got potential. Maybe come back next year and do this course again, and then we'll reassess you. And then you get the ones who are ready to go. So thankfully, I was in the third category of you're good to go now. In fact, I remember when I did my briefing course, and at the end of it, I had wanted to go on in the July, which was like seven, 8 months later. So I thought to myself, right, I've got 7 months to prepare for this. And they said, no, I'll see you in January. I was like, what? And like, I'll see you in January. You're good to go. You're ready to go now. And I was like, shit. And it came forward, you know, pretty quickly. And I had to sort of get my shit together, really. But yeah, so that was how you applied. And at the time, going back from that, you had to have served like 3 years military service before you could apply. Anyone can apply, but there can be a few roadblocks in the way from your parent unit. So the regiment you're serving in at the time, they can suggest you don't, but you know, they can hold you back and they can try and put things in your way. But thankfully, when I went, I had a lot of support. So the head shed that were sort of in charge of me at the time, they were nothing but supportive. They said, yeah, on you go. My company commander at the time, my OC, he let me go home and train for like 7-8 weeks before selection started. He let me go and he said, just go home and train for it, and, you know, fully supported me, which was, you know, forever grateful for, obviously.
What was the separator then when you actually got to SA selection, and what set you, do you think, above those that left within, I say, 2 weeks? So I've read a number of accounts from people that talk about their SES selection, and they quite often refer to the people that often leave early are the ones that are going quite confident. They think they're really physically capable to do it, but all of a sudden, 2 weeks later, they've chopped it. They've gone, no, this isn't for me, whatever it might be, injury, or they just couldn't hack it. It was a complete surprise to them. But in terms of like qualities, now this could be physical, this could be mental, but what do you think separates those that make it to the end of selection versus those that don't, especially in the first 2 weeks, you know, when you're getting rid of the early chaff?
I just think the guys who see it through and get to the end and pass, they're just cut from a different cloth. And I'm going to say that really boldly and say there's something about them that's just different. And it comes down to a few factors. One major factor is that you have to really want it, because no one's going to find it easy. There's always going to be something that will be their Achilles heel, someone who might find the hills fairly doable. So you get some very, very fit, big, strapping, strong lads who can just tab all day, every day, and they never seem to tire. And they do find it easier than the next guy. I knew people like that. There were people on the hills phase who, although it was hard, they never found it to the point where they were at their absolute limit. So they found it maybe easier than the next guy. I found it really hard. I was at my limit with that. I had to push myself to get through the hills phase. I found it really fucking hard. So then you get the guys who don't find that as hard. Then you get to the jungle, and the guys who maybe found that fairly doable, shall we say, crumble in the jungle. Coining that one. But they just seem to find their weakness. It's like their kryptonite, you know? The trees becomes a kryptonite. They can't operate because there's very different environments. And you know, when you look at the hills phase of selection, it's called aptitude for a reason. It's an aptitude to see if you've got the minerals to go forward and do the real selection. That's just the start. So it's a physical and mental test, obviously. And I would say a huge proportion of that is mental to get through it, because it's easy to get out of it. You can voluntarily withdraw yourself anytime you like. You can get to any checkpoint and say, that's me, I'm done. I don't want to go any further. Voluntarily withdraw. And no one argues with you. They don't try and convince you to stay on. No one tries to convince you to stay. Come on, you know, another day. It's like, as soon as you say those words, you're done. You're off.
Very different to the show. I remember the first season of the show, they were like, right, you're VW, right, you're gone. Whereas now they sort of talk them into it a little bit more, staying. You sure you really want to do this? And I can imagine that blatantly doesn't happen in selection.
The reason they do that, when you think about this in real terms, so you have an SES selection candidate, like a candidate for Special Forces selection, and they say those words that they are literally giving up on themselves, on the course. Then operationally, if you are somewhere in the world where you don't have that option to just say, that's me, I'm going home now, but you someone's got that giving up mentality, if that mentality is within there, of they're someone who will give up, then when are they going to do that when it really matters? That's why that's there. And I think it's a really important factor. And that's why the numbers have always been proportionally to you know, when it comes to the ratio of pass rate versus who turns up on day one, it's a very small percentile of people who get to the end and get badged.
And I think it's great that you just came out and said they're cut from a different cloth, because I've been really thinking about this with elite athletes a lot recently. If you look at a number of, I guess, social media accounts where they talk about the qualities that elite athletes have, they talk about, you know, like the discipline, they talk about the openness to change, all of these key things, but they're all very nice. And I just think there's a level of grit. They're cut from a different cloth, which separates them out, which doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, those things are the qualities are necessarily favourable. So say, for example, with an elite athlete, you've got to have a certain level of selfishness, because you've got to have to say no to so many things so you can concentrate on that one goal. Now, that's when people hear the word selfish, they think, oh, that's really negative. Well, in the case of being the best of the best, it's not negative, it's necessary. And it takes a real level, you know, a certain personality to have maybe even a lack of empathy to say, no, I don't care, I need to do this. And that's just one element. But I completely agree. There's so I think it's John Kerouac, the author, who talks about it's always the crazy ones. You know, that you need that level above, or you see the world slightly differently compared to everyone else, to be able to do things that no one else is willing to do. I mean, I've read the stories of the, you know, how the SES was first formed with, I can't remember the names, but there was a particular Irishman who was particularly crazy, and he was a bare knuckle boxer. Yeah. He got like caps for the Lions in the 1938 South African tour. Like, this guy just was a cut above everyone else because he just was willing to go to places that no one else was going to. And you need to be cut from a different cloth to be able to do that. And I think a lot of people want to think that they are that, but I, you know, if that was the case, then the 0.1% of the 0.1% of the 0.1%, it wouldn't be such a small margin. There'll be loads of people like it. So yeah, I think it's great to hear you say that. It's like a good, strong honesty. It's like, you might have it, well, you might not.
Yeah.
Or you'd cut from a different cloth.
And what happens, and how is that cloth cut? Where's it cut from? I mean, you look at the backgrounds, but if you track back into the backgrounds of most of the guys that do this, they're usually from very similar backgrounds. And that is usually, you know, when you look at where does a special forces recruit from? So most of the SAS come from either the parachute regiment or other infantry units. But they're all frontline infantry soldiers, which is a cutting edge of the army, right? They're the guys at the pointy end. And where do they come from? People who join the infantry are usually from non-privileged backgrounds. So they're from council estates of rough areas. A lot of people back in the day, I was talking to someone the other day who was telling me a story about an old school regiment guy. He was pretty much going to go to prison. It was going to be jail or the army. And there's a lot of that back then. There was a lot of guys who just did it because they had nothing else to do, or they were looking at a life of crime if they didn't do something otherwise. And they focused on something more positive. So a lot of it was a bit of a rescue situation for young lads back in the day. So you look at guys who've come from a life of crime, or a life of, you know, growing up in a council estate, a rough area, and then those guys are the ones who have had to grow up with a certain level of resilience anyway. So the chances are they get a lot of them get left to fend for themselves and their kids. They saw some shit when they were young, and they've almost been preconditioned to deal with crap. And so that's like the trajectory, that's the typical trajectory of an SAS soldier. So when you look at what the final product of that is, or the ongoing product, shall we say, from someone passing selection onwards, you just get this character who has never had a life of comfort. They've always had to deal with some level of shit through their lives. So, and that builds layers of resilience that you don't even appreciate or know about at the time, but you have it. And then when it comes to those who start versus those who finish, then it's just it's going through that rinsing process. You're rinsing it out all the time until you're left with the gold at the end, you know.
Yeah, if we link that back to what we said earlier around the ability to tolerate stress over a really long period of time. Like, if you had quite a privileged upbringing, you would have thought that your resilience to that stress is probably a little bit lower, purely because of the type of upbringing that you've had. Whereas, I guess, a non-privileged background, if you're constantly having to fend for yourself, you know, your ability to take on hardship is going to be a lot better, purely because you're a lot more, you've had regular exposure to it throughout your life. I know I keep linking this back to elite athletes, but I think that's a good link because, you know, we're talking about the elite. Just because the SES isn't necessarily a sport, it's still the top end. And there is research out there that most of the time with elite athletes, they would have gone through some form of hardship within their family or within their close community, which has enabled them a certain level of drive, resilience, which has helped them with their training. It helped them with their focus to get towards a particular goal, which is weird when you talk about the determinants, because sometimes if you just get, I don't know, a 16-year-old, wherever they're from, and they ask, like, what do I need to get into the SAS? like they don't necessarily have the most control out of their upbringing. So it's like, well, like, you know, yeah. What was your upbringing like? You didn't come from a non-privileged background. Might struggle. It's quite an interesting quality or determinant to think about.
Okay, so here's another way to think about this, right? Because this is the other thing I always think about with this. In the military, and let's talk about selection. You have two categories, right? So you have other ranks and you have officers. Officers don't come from the same background, right? So you could say, well, why do a handful of those get through on selection as well? Because they need officers as much as they need soldiers, other ranks. But I was going to just say this when it comes to competitive athletes from certain disciplines, or when it comes to officers, commissioned officers in the military. Commissioned officers often come from privileged backgrounds, right? Very wealthy families, sometimes. So the difference, I think, look at Olympic rowers. Olympic rowers don't usually come from shithole backgrounds, right? They usually come from good backgrounds. They've gone to rowing club and stuff when they're young. So sometimes going to private school. So you could say, well, same kind of deal with that. You know, they come from good upbringings, good environments, you know, wealthy environments sometimes. So with that, then it's a human thing. It just comes down to some people just have that extra gravy that others don't. So when it comes to those who make the Olympics on a team, those who make an individual sport discipline at the highest level, world championship, it just comes down to personal drive and grit and determination and the purpose of doing what they're doing. I think it's a huge link to that is having such a strong purpose to have that accolade, or it's not necessarily an accolade in the special forces. You don't do it for the prize at the end. It's just really about the being in that environment and doing that job. But there is something about every man who gets through that who just has an extra level of grit, drive and determination than the next guy. As simple as that, really. It's just the reason I say that about the unprivileged backgrounds typically being, that's typically where that would come from. Where guys from their regiment, they would usually come from the infantry, which come from, you know, council estates. You know, and that's just a lot of averages. But again, there are people from those backgrounds who would never even scratch the surface with, you know, SAS selection. Just because you come from a council estate doesn't make you hard as nails or have the attitude to do special forces selection. I'm not saying that, but that's just typically the background that they recruit from. You look at boxers, look at MMA fighters, look at boxers. Most world championship boxers don't come from privileged backgrounds. They've got a huge reason to, you know, like when you see a championship level boxer who comes from nothing and to get to the top, you know, like the hungry wolf climbing the hill, to get to the top, there's such massive purpose behind getting to that point, getting to the top of the hill, getting that world championship level belt. That's when the big money comes in. Look at somebody like Conor McGregor, you know, give up everything he had to then solely focus on his martial arts career to then become a UFC fighter and make his life that way. You know, there is huge drive and a lot of reason to get there. But then once they get there and all the other stuff comes, like the millions and the fame and all that, then all of a sudden you see this typical trajectory of the hunger starts to go, and then that's when they become vulnerable and weak to hungry wolves climbing the hill. You know, they say, what's that saying again? The wolf climbing the hill is hungrier than the wolf at the top of the hill, whatever it is. Yeah, I believe that as well. So I think, aside from what does it take, I think in anything in life, not just special forces selection or athletics or sport, I think if you've got a huge purpose and drive and a reason why you're getting up in the morning and doing what you're doing, that's the thing that's going to keep driving you forward, even if you don't want to do it.
And this must be why mindset has, you know, exploded in terms of people want to know more about mindset. How can I develop my mindset to really take me to the next level? Because they realize that, you know, over time I can develop myself physically, but there's always that level of mindset which could take me that last 10%, which could, you know, get me nearer my ceiling. Whether this person's cut from this, you know, different cloth or not, you know, they can still have some level of resiliency, some level of drive, some level of purpose, which will improve them in whatever area that they want to develop in. But I guess that's where people want to know more about the mindset from the SAS, because they feel like, actually, I can improve to here. But knowing maybe a little bit more about the mindset of those in the SAS might just get me nearer to where that level is. Yeah. Whether they're cut from the same cloth can I get as close to that cloth as possible?
I would say it comes down to exposure in anything, whether it's cold water therapy, whether it's heat therapy, whether it's running a marathon, long distance endurance running, whatever it is that you want to do, if there's anything that needs a strong mindset for, in particular, you know, you need to do the thing. You know, there's a lot of people out there who will read all the SAS books and wear through dark clothing, but they won't ever put a pack on their back and walk up a hill, or when they do, they're hanging out their ass within 10 minutes. So it really is about, you know, if you want to develop, and you know this, Phil, if you want to develop a strong mindset, you need to build it. It's like a muscle. You need to build it. You're not born with everything you need. You have to work at everything. So the more you expose yourself to hard stuff, each time you get to the end of something, you then build another layer of resilience. You've now got evidential proof that's now in the past that you can do something. And that's now your standard moving forward. There was a girl the other day who did the fan dance event, and she, you know, I was really impressed with her because she was at the turnaround. She was at the halfway point, waited as well. She was at the halfway point, 26-year-old girl, went and did this event by herself. She got to the halfway point and she was suffering really badly with cramp. Now, you'll have had cramp as much as I have and the next guy has. We've all had cramp. If we're into anything physical, we've all experienced cramp and it's really uncomfortable, right? And it's debilitating to a point where if you can't sort it there and then, it can literally just stop you in your tracks. And it can be quite a scary thing to happen, especially if you're out on a mountain somewhere. So this girl was suffering badly with cramp. I gave her a little bit of advice and help. If you got some electrolytes with you, get it down you know, keep moving. Anyway, I then went back to the finish point and I watched her come in. You know, she was in a really bad way. You could tell that she was in a lot of pain. At the end, she just kept on saying, "I can't believe I've done it. You know, I can't believe I finished it." I was like, "Well, look," I says, "the thing is," I said, you've come and done this today." I said, "You didn't really know what to expect. You had half an idea, but now you know what to expect. You know what it's taken." I said, "And now you're that percentage more resilient. You've just built another layer of resilience to your character today by doing this. You now have evidential proof that you can do this." I said, "And you know how much you had to push to get through that. You've now discovered something else about your personality. So it's always like a new level you mark, and you know, moving forward, you go, right, I can do that. I've done that before. I know I can do something like that again. I know I can deal with pain." And everyone's got their ways that they deal with that. Everyone's got different ways that they accommodate that and deal with it at the time. You know, whatever method that is that you use. I used to always use the one foot in front of the other. You know, pick a point, go to that point, and then don't think about anything else. Then get to that point, think about the next point. Whatever it is, it works for you, right? But you learn a lot about yourself when you do hard shit. And you've done lots of hard shit in your life. And when you do that, you always find something out about yourself.
Chase hard shit. Chase different types of hard shit. And then that will give you a well-rounded level of resilience. Mm-hmm. For someone that's looking to go down the route, possibly going for selection. So with your example, you with a mate, you went out and did some of the courses at the Brecon Beacons, got a pack on. So you at least had some experience experiencing the hardness of those types of events before you had to do it in selection. When it comes to slightly more mental things, like I know there's a part of selection where you get interrogated, there are stress positions.
Yeah.
Would you recommend for that person to, like, you know, maybe practice spending a long time in stress positions, practice having the noise that they pump into your headphones to keep you up all night? Is that like a level of hard that someone should maybe chase just to give them some exposure to that before doing selection?
In all honesty, no. Things like that, you've either got it or you've not. You can prepare yourself physically. When it comes to something like that, that's the test. You're going to find out if you're the kind of person who can deal with this shit or not.
Mm.
Because it's not something I personally want to practice. It's not something I would recommend someone tries to simulate or inoculate themselves with. It's just something that I would say, just deal with it at the time. And it's how you deal with it at the time that gets you through it. You're never going to enjoy it. And the thing is, you can't always replicate the situation as is. So you can spar when you're getting ready for a boxing match, but it's not the same as having a full-on fight. You know, it's not quite the same. You don't have every element there. You don't have a crowd. You don't have full, you know, you can spar, obviously. You can do full sparring and boxing training. but you don't have every single element to simulate that exact experience with all the pressure that's around you and stuff. So when it comes to something like interrogation or staying in stress positions for a long time and listening to white noise, I think that's the kind of thing you want to do that once, hopefully. You want to just do it once. And then you just got to get on with it in time. And that's when you got to find what is driving you. You've got to think, how are you going to cope with this? Because you kind of know, on the selection course, you know it's not real, right? So people have said things like, oh yeah, apparently like you get into interrogation and your head goes and you get that confused that you can't tell if it's real or not. And you fucking know it's a training exercise, right? It's a course, for God's sake. You know in your heart of hearts, it's just a course. That's why I always told myself, this is just a course. No one's going to kill me. Yeah, I'm going to be in the pain. I'm going to be cold. I'm going to be wet. I'm going to be hungry. I'm going to be really fucking sore. But it's just something I have to deal with for a period of time. And I kind of know roughly what that time is, because you know it's going to be 36 hours. And on regular selection, you're in captivity for 36 hours in stress positions or interrogated. Interrogation was the break. That was the thing I used to always think to myself of. You get allowed to go to the toilet. You can raise your hand, you can go to the toilet and get taken to the toilet. Or you get interrogated and you're interrogated every few hours. You know, for 36 hours. It is very, very taxing on the mind. You don't sleep. You can't sleep. You've maybe a minute of sleep now and then in a stress position. But you certainly don't sleep. You're catching little bits of very light sleep intermittently. Dazed, you're confused, you hallucinate, you hear things. I always remember when I was hearing white noise for that. You know, it's like an illusion. When you hear solid white noise, it's like your mind starts to find a way of dealing with that. So I always remember when I was in the interrogation phase and selection, and I was in stress positions, and I was, the white noise is constant. I started to hear trance music through the white noise. I always remember that. It was like trance tunes, you know, like late 90s, early 2000s trance music. I remember I was starting to hear trance tracks, and I thought someone was playing music. There's a lot of playing music for us. And it was all in my head, because you get debriefed at the end and you ask all these questions and they say, did you hear anything? Did they like noise? It's obviously a common thing. And I told them that. They were like, oh, okay, that's interesting. But you find a way to deal with it, right?
Yeah.
It's a coping mechanism.
Yeah. It's interesting that your brain automatically does that. It's almost like trying to find a way of making something less stressful.
Yeah.
I mean, surely the brain, the human tissue is always trying to find ways of making things less stressful for the body, isn't it? So it's interesting when it's put under such stress like that, it can come up with things like that.
And that was quite late on as well. That was probably two-thirds of the way through that started to happen. Like probably the last sort of like 10 hours or something like that, I started to hear that. It's like a coping mechanism. Because when you know something's towards the end as well, and the other thing as well, when it was getting more difficult, when they were putting more shit on you, I had this inclination that it's got to be near the end. Like at one point, they take you outside and they snap ties like plastic cuffs, and they secure you to a wooden pallet outside, and they hose you down with freezing cold water, and you don't know when they're going to stop, and it's like fucking, it's bolting. But I always remember at that point, I thought, surely they're not going to keep us here for much longer. You know, this is like, yeah, everyone's in bits at this point. You know, it's been a long time. You've been in the run for 5 days before that as well, so you're hungry anyway.
With your selection, but how many people entered that interrogation phase and how many people came out?
Yeah, there are several phases of selection. It's 6 months in its entirety. So you have like the hills, you have pre-jungle training, you have jungle school, you have observation post phase, you have escape and evasion, interrogation. That's a couple of weeks. And from day one selection, I think it was like 250 to 280 people day one selection. And at the end there was 23 actually, quite a high pass rate. That was included officers, that was SPS, SAS, other ranks and officers. So I think there was like maybe 18, I think something like that. I think it was maybe 18 that was passed. But before that, you lose most people are lost in the hills phase, because they're trying to, that first filter process of, and these are all guys who've passed the briefing course, so that you've got a certain level, but then week one is usually you'll lose the most people in week one. On the fan dance, there's a lot that don't get through that, because it's a very fast time you have to achieve on that march. And then I think there was something like 50 went to the jungle, quite a lot withdrew, and then some failed, quite a lot failed. at the end of that phase. And I think by the time we went on to combat and survival, there was probably like 20-odd people left. And then from that, there was only a couple failed, actually. It's not a high failure rate on that. You got a lot of, you think about the man that goes into that phase has gone through a lot of stuff to start with. You know, he's gone through more than half the selection at that point. You're like almost two-thirds of the way through. So you get a very capable man, you know, decent soldier, who's had to prove himself through the jungle and all the rest of it to go on combat and survival. And it's still hard, but it's like the last major hurdle to get through on selection, I would say. The rest of it after that is kind of a bit of a given. You know, you're expected to pass. The jungle is obviously the hardest phase.
The first thing that comes to my mind is I think the jungle phase would be the hardest for me. I don't want to be one of those people that, you know, think that, yeah, I reckon I could do it. Because I just don't know. But if I had to pick a particular phase out of all of them, which I think I'd struggle most with, it would be jungle.
Remember, when you weigh up the difference between something like altitude, which is the hills phase, versus the jungle, it's very, very different in this assessment. So you're not really assessed as such on the hills phase. You're just expected to get from A to B. And if you keep your head down and just turn up, you show up with the right equipment, with the right weight in your back, and you start and you finish and you, in the time, you pass. As long as you don't do anything untoward, you're not being assessed on how you are as a soldier, unless you're doing something completely obscure, like turn up with, you know, your kits and shit state or something like that. And they're always going to point out, oh, if you can't map read, you can't navigate. If you can't map read or navigate, you won't pass anyway because you won't go through test week. So if you can get through test week, you can navigate, you can tab, you can carry the weight, you can follow instruction. That is all it's designed to do, is to get the man who has the physical aptitude to do hard stuff. Then when you go to the jungle, that's when it really starts. So the jungle phase is all about how do you perform as a soldier? How do you operate? What are your skills like? Yeah. And that's the hardest part of the jungle phase, is that you have to be highly skilled. And it's not like you have to learn all this new stuff and be highly skilled at everything, but you have to have an extremely high standard of basic soldiering skills. That's the difference. And you need to maintain those for a lengthy period of time. And that's what they're looking at. So things like live firing, what your drills, how slick are your drills when you're in a contact? How quickly can you work as individually as a part of a team to go through the drills and be very, very slick at those drills and be safe and be a good operator? And it's little things like strip down your weapon, show me your weapon first thing in the morning. If you've not cleaned your weapon, it's a mark. You know, if you've not put cam cream on your face enough, like, that's a mark. And they're always marking things off. If you leave your pouch open, it's a black mark. If you leave something behind in the harbour area, After you get ready in the morning and you bug out of the harbour area to go on your first move, the DS will go in and assess the area to find something like a fucking tissue paper or a sweet wrapper. Who the fuck is this, right? And they want to know. And then if you leave something behind, that's a big no-no. So it's these types of things. And when you're tired, when you're under pressure, when you are nervous, essentially about, you know, how you're doing on the course, because these guys that assess you are fucking the experienced SAS soldiers or Special Forces soldiers coming from the SBS and SAS. They're experienced Special Forces soldiers who have been through that. They've served several years in the Sabre Squadron. They've been operational multiple times. They've got their shit together and they know what they're looking for. You're assessed at a very high level. So that's the difficulty with the jungle, is it's not necessarily down to you. You can do your absolute best, which is really the most important part. If you do your absolute best, you don't get in. You just weren't good enough. You weren't what they're looking for. But when you get to the end of that, you're then being judged essentially on your abilities as a soldier. And that's the part that's out of your control then. You just have to hope that you're good enough.
Yeah. I'm just going to interrupt here to quickly thank our sponsors. Hydrate by Human24. Hydrate is a fast and effective formula to improve hydration by replacing fluid and body salts after an intense training session or after a long night's sleep. Each sachet contains an optimal ratio of sodium, potassium, and magnesium to improve cellular hydration. I highly recommend the citrus flavor, which I always take immediately upon waking. It really sets my day up perfectly. Head to human24.com, that's HMN24.com, where you can get a month's supply of 30 sachets and use the code FILL10 at checkout for 10% off. Now, let's get back into the conversation. In terms of physical, I know we talked a lot about how quite often at the beginning of selection, you'd have a load of people that were really, really physically fit, do really well on the hill phase, et cetera, et cetera. So if you had to sort of list key qualities that a soldier would physically need to reach that highest level of the SAS, what do you think they would be?
When it comes to the physical side of things, there are people who pass selection for a long, long time now. You don't necessarily, you know, have a multifaceted approach to fitness. Most of the guys back when I did selection, you know, some of the guys didn't see the inside of a gym. They just got a burger in their back and just, they were good at tabbing with a burger in their back. And essentially, that's all you need to be able to do, really, is to be able to put a pack on your back and keep it on your back for a long time and cover a long expanse of terrain, over rough terrain, you know, and not sort of give up. So there wasn't really any need for it. I mean, back then there wasn't the advances that we have these days in fitness, where everyone's doing CrossFit or something similar. Yeah, and you know, and they've got a very multifaceted approach to conditioning. But it goes without saying, had that knowledge and the existence of, you know, the common existence of, say, of how everyone these days wants to be fit. You know, young lads these days are in the gym. You know, when I was in the army, right in my younger years, we would go home and leave and we'd be in the pub. Nowadays, young lads are going to the gym. They're making that a huge part of their lives. I don't think it's changed the way that people perform on selection, because it's still the same tests. But I would say that the approach to it these days, not just on the selection phase, but in the regimental phase, which I've been privy to the, you know, what goes on inside there as far as the physical elements of each soldier goes. And there's a lot more emphasis being put now on health, fitness, conditioning, you know, recovery. All these things have been really adhered to these days, which is a great thing. To answer your question, if I was going to prepare someone for that process, for example, then there is so much you can do physically. Then the rest of it is down to their mindset and how resilient they are. What goes on upstairs, that's the biggest part, it always will be. But if I was going to make all things equal and say, right, what could we physically do to make this person as capable as possible? It would be a combination of all things. So there would be a lot of hill fitness. There'd be a lot of getting a pack on your back and covering a lot of distance and terrain over the hills. I would add in a lot of swimming, weight training, but a conditioning program that you and I would likely prescribe to a client, with a combination of strength training, conditioning, a lot of dynamic work. There'd be a bunch of everything, but the emphasis would be on overall balance of a training program, so that you're working the whole body rather than just concentrating on one thing. Now, I wouldn't say that there's any need to get big or muscular, nothing like that. I'd say that's maybe a disadvantage. I would say most of it has come down to endurance work and doing basic strength work. That's what I would recommend. And not doing too fancy, nothing too fancy.
Really interesting to hear you say that, because you can imagine that, right, we need to get you physically prepared for this. We need to get your strength to this level, fitness to this level, and they'll have these sort of test measures which they might use. But sometimes I feel that people might do a load of that, but then start losing sight of the main key thing that's going to make them good, which is what you described, their ability to put a burden on their back and to cover large distances over a long period of time. So it's all about being able to tolerate that, rather than like, oh, what's your mile time? So you could have a good mile time, you could have a bad mile time. It will depend on your ability to tolerate stress over a long period of time. So yeah, I can imagine people sort of overcomplicating things, and they have this image of this like big burly soldier, you know, he's the pinnacle of fitness, he'll be able to last forever. And it's like, well, no, like you said, size may actually be a disadvantage, because one, you need to carry that weight over a long period of time on top of the weight of your burger, and that might actually be a big disadvantage. It's almost like be as light as possible, but strong enough, and have a good level of tolerance in like tissues, muscle, bone, tendon, etc., to last a long period of time. Yeah, the idea of what this perfect soldier might look like might actually surprise the sort of average viewer, especially when they see like SAS Who Dares Wins, because I don't know, Jason Fox, they're all big guys, you know, they all look pretty big in a black top.
Yeah, but you look at somebody like Jason Fox, most people don't look like that. He's an exception, I would say, as far as, he's just a very well-built guy. He's in great shape. Probably always kept himself in good shape, but he's probably genetically quite lucky as well, I would say. You get the outliers who are just like, even if he didn't train, he'd probably still look pretty decent. But he does train, so he looks really good, you know. So he's got a real good physique on him. And then you get other guys like look at Billy. I mean, I know Billy, and Billy was always quite a slight build guy. But you know, he's more of a boxer, more of a sort of endurance kind of build. Not got massive muscles or anything like that, but it's about, it's not having like a one size fits all approach and everyone looks like a universal soldier. You get a very diverse bunch of people. So you get, I remember there were guys when I joined the regiment who I would look at and go, fucking hell, how did I fat bastard get into the regiment? Yeah, they look like just big chunky guys, overweight in some cases, but they're just like just big bears of men who can put a burger in the back and keep going and never falter. They're never going to be able to have a good mile time in a run. They're not designed for running, but let's face it, how often do you really need to run fast? In a contact and stuff, short bursts, but you know, you don't really ever have to go and run a mile and a half and do it fast. It's not really, doesn't really come into the category of what you need to do in your typical day as a soldier. So there are different things that people are strong and weak at, and I think it's getting the guy who can be pretty good at most things. So guy who can run enough but not necessarily be a Mo Farah style runner, someone who can put a burger in the back but not someone who needs to fucking really be able to lift, you know, 250 kilos off the floor. So it really is, there are many, you know, the regimental soldier comes in many guys, as you know, they're all built and look differently. But I would say these days there's a lot more adaptation to the physical side of things as far as overall conditioning, how properly training to be that rounded. And it's not just that, I think a big part of the modern day soldier now is that the likelihood of, because they approach things differently now, there's a high likelihood bar injury, is that they'll last longer in life, as in they'll be healthier for longer. Back in the old days of the typical regimental soldier, whereby they just stick a burger in the back and they tab, but they would never train, they would never do fitness, they would get on the piss, they would do the job, it was never really about the rounded approach to physical fitness or nutrition or anything like that. There were no supplements or any of that shit. So if you look at that era and how that era ended up moving on to later stages of life, a lot of them were like packs of broken biscuits physically in life because they didn't look after themselves. And obviously you and I both know that a huge part of looking after yourself is nutrition, hydration, supplementation, getting good sleep. Now, looking at all the things that help us perform better and optimize our health, these things are only really coming to the forefront now for the majority of people for the open market. Whereas beforehand, for years before, it was only athletes that did that type of stuff. You know, even special forces soldiers didn't do it. You know, so this is all part of the evolution of the modern man, obviously. But you know, certainly things have changed.
Yeah. Well, speaking of things changing and things becoming more open to the rest of society, you've obviously got the Modern Warrior Project. Do you want to talk a little bit more about that? Because you're obviously teaching skills and physical training for people, I guess, outside of the military, and how they can utilize these skills to make them better in whatever field that they're in. So you want to talk a little bit more about that and how you know, like the success stories of how you're seeing these skills being put into place and the success stories from it.
You know, when it comes to purpose, when it comes to doing what you're doing in life and knowing that you're doing the right thing, you'll have the same drill, you know, doing what you do. There was a period of time in my life where I wasn't really sure I was doing the right thing. You know, because when I was in the military, I joined the military at a young age. I knew I was doing the right thing. I felt like I was in the right place, having a great time. I joined the SAS. Again, that followed on, that carried over. And I felt like I was living my best life and I loved my time in the regiment. When I left the regiment and I knew that there was something just underlying that was telling me that something else out there was calling me, and something else that was different to what I was doing now had to be done. So I almost had this knowing that it was time to leave, for whatever reason it was. And it didn't come overnight, but as time went on, I just started to get this feeling that this is the end of this chapter, I need to do something else. And I think for me, it was about gaining back control of my life. Because when you're institutionalized and you're controlled by the military, you are controlled. Your life is dictated by the profession that you're part of. So you're told what to do when you're doing it. Not in a boot camp style sense. I'm talking about, you know, working away, getting called away to operations. You're on call constantly. It's a lot of pressure on your life. And if you've got family and stuff as well, it becomes even more so. So I guess I had a bit of foresight with that, thinking forward, going, right, in 5 years' time, if I've got kids and I'm married, you know, the people who have gone before me, how does their lives look? And I would hear things like, you know, guys growing up and, like, so guys with kids growing up and they've never really seen their kids. I got this feeling that I wasn't really going to be completely happy moving forward with it. I thought, I want to build a family and, you know, I want to get control of my life. I need to leave. So when I left and I you know, went to security work for a bit, then I opened my first gym. I ended up having like a couple of gyms over the space of 15 years. Recently, well, 18 months ago, that was the end of my gym career. And then I went on to what I'm doing now, which is coaching men over 40 on the Modern Warrior Project. Now, when it comes to purpose, when it comes to feeling like you're doing the right thing in life, I went through this period where I just wasn't quite sure what I should be doing. So there was a lot of uncertainty as far as, you know, the question you ask yourself, well, am I really doing the right thing? You know, I kind of like what I'm doing. Some of the things that I'm doing, I enjoy, but really, is it really serving me in my life to the point where I think that I'm in the right place doing the right thing? And the reality was that I wasn't. And I used things like competitive bodybuilding going back years before that. You know, I loved bodybuilding, but I think it was filling a void. It was doing something that I love to do, but that was very personal. It was very much pushing myself physically and mentally to do something like a discipline of bodybuilding that was replacing the discipline of something I'd had before. So I don't think I was really in the right space for a long time. And then lockdown happened and I started going into a bit of online coaching. For most people, lockdown was a bit of a chance to step back and have a look at your life and ask yourself the right questions. So for me, I sort of got the wide angle lens on and thought about things. I realized that I liked working with guys who I could really relate to, who could relate to me, who I could connect with, who I was resonating with essentially more than anybody. And a lot of that came through feedback from places like Instagram. There were common denominators there. At the same time, I could see certain problems in the world from a general perspective of like men over a certain age. They were having these common challenges in life. And I thought there was a huge calling for helping men similar to my age who I could really relate to and help. And the more I thought about it, the more four-dimensional this became. So I would walk around on a day-to-day basis. I would subconsciously be not judging people in a bad way, but I was talking to people. They would say something to me, or I would look at someone and I would see why interpret as someone who wasn't really living the best life. And I was like, oh, there's so many people need help. So like when I get up in the morning now, I was like, people need my help. Not in a way that it's like, oh, people need me like a fucking superhero. I'm not talking about that. I'm saying it gives me drive and purpose to go, I need to fucking do this. There's more to life than just me and my selfish needs. The Modern Warrior Project started as a thing that I created to kind of be in line with the people who I wanted to coach. The more that I submerged myself in that and as that's evolved, it's become even more evident that, yeah, this is where I should be. And it almost happened by accident. Not completely, but it almost happened not in an ultra-planned way. It just sort of happened and evolved. And as I was going down this path of coaching men over 40, I thought, yeah, this is really what I know I should be doing this. And I know I'm in the right place now. So that's really where the drive comes from that. So for me, it's about how can I now scale this in a way that myself and other people that may be in the same space or similar that are doing some, that are running similar programs for men of a certain age. It's like, well, there's a lot of people, excuse my French, but there's a lot of people need to sort of unfuck themselves out there. And that's the way that I approach this. And how can I be of help to these men who really need accountability and structure and have to refine their purpose in life again, realize they're not past the best. And that's really the angle that I come from with this. And everyone's different. There's a very diverse bunch of people come into the program, but they all have similar common challenges that can be dealt with. And not only that, it's about being part of something, because people want to belong to something, don't they? Human beings are social creatures. They want to belong to something. So it's not all about, I need to lose X amount of pounds to get to the ideal shape and get a six pack. A lot of it is like, come to the program with challenges and problems, or maybe be in a position where you feel you're not quite achieving your best, and then get into an environment where you can be part of a community that you might not have otherwise. So if someone works in a factory as a supervisor and they're surrounded by negative dickheads all day long, and then they find their new circle inside a remote program that they can become part of and meet new people that are like-minded, then the power really is in the community of the program.
You're essentially problem solving. You haven't just set something up. So, look, I've been in the military. I'm going to take advantage of this because it seems a bit popular at the moment. You know, learn all the skills that I know, learn my mindset. It's not like that at all. Like you've created something which is solving a problem for a demographic, which quite often gets a bit lost at that particular time in their lives. You're giving them key mindset skills, really. It's the level of grit, resilience, and a purpose, which is what you had to, which led you to towards your success with your SAS career. And it's cool you're using those skills to sort of help others. And you're definitely right, Ed, we're very social creatures. We crave that community. And you definitely see, you know, things that have developed success. I don't know whether it would be CrossFit, all sorts of things. But I think the big thing which has really developed them has been the fact that they created a community out of.
Absolutely,
and
yeah.
It's, you need a community to help direction, because a community is, the reason a community is there is because something's bringing those people together, and usually there's purpose and direction behind it. So that's really cool to see.
It's like one-to-one coaching. It's like one-to-one coaching is less effective, I think. It really is. Because you don't get the power of community and stuff. You don't get that with a one-to-one client. Unless it's something very, very particular that someone needs help with, then I'm a huge believer in this sort of group coaching method that I wasn't really a fan of before. Going back a few years ago, I wasn't really a huge fan of it. I didn't really understand it as much, even though I'd been in a community myself, of, you know, in the military. And in all honesty, I unconsciously, by accident, created a program that's helped me personally with the same things. So strangely enough, everything that the guys need in the program that they come to me for, I need also. Now, I'm maybe a step ahead when they come on the program because I've been doing this stuff a long time and physically keep myself in shape. And all my habits, like, you'll be the same. You know, we come from the same sort of thought processes and all the rest of it. You know, we look after ourselves. We eat the right foods. We get our sleep. We're very into our optimizing our circadian rhythm and all that. Hence, you know, be part of the Human 2014. You know, so we've got that already, and we understand the benefits of that. So it's essentially guiding men through the same process so they can optimize themselves. But when I think about everything that I provide them with and what the rest of the community provides them with, I always see this as you're not like you said a minute ago, I'm not on this pedestal going, you know, I was in the special forces. I know everything about mental resilience and personal development. Come and I'll show you what you need to do to be under my umbrella. It's like, nah, I don't see that. We all work together. You know, I'm part of the group as well. Yeah, I might lead the group, but they're all leading themselves as well. They're all individual leaders in their own right. They have companies. They can be in charge of organizations. They could be multimillionaires. They could be people with a lot of responsibility who need leadership. But leadership starts with yourself, as you know. You know, you have to lead yourself first before you can lead anybody else. So a big part of it is leadership, and it's ownership of yourself and your daily routines and habits and how you lead yourself through life. So I always see this as I am part of this tribe as well, and we work together. And I have my faults. I have my needs. I often, you know, I'll sometimes lean into a client who's got a particular expertise and say, what do you think of this? Like some of the guys who are more senior now, maybe evolved in a sense that, and I always say this when the guys come on the program, there are different levels to this. There are different phases. Initially, you come because you need help with something because you don't have that knowledge or expertise or the structure, whatever it may be. Come for the help. You stay for the community. But what happens with a lot of people is they come on and they work on optimizing themselves. So we always start with optimizing self as the first stage. And that comes down to all your non-negotiables, your self-care non-negotiables and all that. And then it's about actualizing your potential. What can I really achieve? Now that I have this robust vehicle to move through life, how does that journey now look? What are my new destinations? What goals can I now set myself? Because I've got new standards physically and mentally. Then what can I really achieve? And so they're actualizing potential. Then they get to the point where they achieve some great things, and then other people coming up behind them, they're then transcending all that knowledge to them. So it does full circle. So now what you've got the beauty of is guys that have been in the program for 2.5 years now helping out on the contributors to the program.
And they always say the best leaders are the ones that bring the best out of everyone else. They don't tell other people what to do.
Absolutely.
You know, if you're exposed to a community which is full of people that have a load of different skill sets, like, you'd be silly not to take full advantage of that.
Absolutely, yeah. But that's where you got to check your ego in. You got to check the ego. That's what gets in the way of a lot of it. People's ego run the show, and they let it run the show. So they feel that, you know, it'd be like me not being transparent. So we have certain rules on the program, and one of those is transparency. Transparency needs a high level of honesty. So when it comes to shares and, you know, what's going not so well in life at the moment, you know, I am the first one to put my hand up and say, guys, you know, I had a bit of a shit week last week. Because what that then does is it builds trust, and it lets them know that, oh, this guy's not claiming to be perfect. He also has his faults, and he's been honest about it. So therefore, I now feel comfortable to share my faults or my fuck-ups, you know, and that's what then, when you can do the diagnosis in yourself and share that, that's when you get the most help. But it's about admitting the fact that, yeah, you know what, something's not quite right here. I need help with this. Lean in and not shy away from it and not pretend that everything's hunky-dory when it's not.
That's really cool to hear. I know there's a lot around, I guess, promoting men to be a bit more vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
I quite often don't, what you described is, look, guys, I've had a bit of a shit week this week. Explain why, explain how you felt about it and how you're currently dealing with it. Guys, have you got any advice? It's interesting to see that seen as vulnerable. I don't know, weirdly, maybe it is, but weirdly, I've never seen that as vulnerability. You know, to assume that someone's never having a hard time or you're always perfect all the time is just misleading. So just admitting that you've got times when you're feeling not too great or things haven't gone to plan, it's weird that's seen as vulnerable because, I don't know, I don't see that as vulnerable. If I had to follow a particular leader, like, I wouldn't see them as vulnerable if they were admitting that they struggle at something. But to me, that isn't vulnerability. That's just, I guess, transparency and builds trust. I then trust that leader because they are being honest with me. So I feel I can be honest with them.
Yeah.
And that's going to help develop relationship in whatever way that relationship then goes further.
Absolutely. And that's one of the core principles of leadership is about trust.
Mm.
You know, people need to, if someone doesn't trust you, they won't want to follow you. You know, they won't have the trust in you to follow you to the shit house, never mind somewhere potentially threatening. So you need to build that trust, and that can take time. But the one thing that we all start with is honesty. And one of the things I always say to the guys in the first turn-up is you need to stop lying to yourself. Because most people will lie to themselves to keep themselves safe or protected from the problem they need to face. So they'll justify things, they'll lie to themselves. So I always say, look, when you stop lying to yourself, then you start to deal with things that are really important. Otherwise, you'll just ignore shit that's really important and then continuously have that same pain and continuously have to lie to yourself. And that's just a pattern that develops and ferments over time. And the longer it goes on, the harder it is to undo.
How can anyone get involved with the Modern Warrior Project?
I always send someone to my application form, so I don't have a website, and it's not because I want to keep it all mystique. Remember I was saying at the beginning of the podcast about the mystique of the regiment. It's not intentional in that sense. I am actually having a new website built at the moment, but at the moment it's all through my Instagram. All my applicants have gone through all organically through my Instagram, and that's on my Linktree on my Instagram profile, and it's the Modern Warrior Project application form. It's right at the top. So that's the first thing anyone has to do is fill out a questionnaire, an application process to get through that initial stage of filtration so that I can then decide who obviously goes to the next stage. And then it's all, every single person who comes on that program, I personally interview myself. So it doesn't go through a sales team. I speak to every single person that comes on that program. It's a quick call to start with, and then obviously they get moved on to the next stage if they're successful. Or it's a polite, this isn't probably going to work, maybe isn't the best way. And that could be either way, you know, prospects come on a call before who have decided that it's probably not best for them, for whatever reason, or they might not be a good fit. So I have to look after the integrity of the group and the tribe of guys I've got on already, that everyone's going to be a good fit for the program. That can be on a multitude of different reasons.
Mm.
But it's like anything else, you know, it has to be, you know, a round peg in a round hole. Otherwise, it's not going to work.
Honesty from the start, even before you're in, honesty is key.
Absolutely, yeah. I have to do that because it's about, if I don't do that, then it's going to be the rock of the landslide. If you start getting people who aren't a fit for the program in, it's just not going to work. It will never work. So, yeah. But anyone who essentially wants to forge the best version of themselves in whatever aspect of life, it doesn't always have to be someone with problems. It could be a lot of my clients come to me because life's going good, but it could be better. So people who are coasting along, sometimes people who are too comfortable are in that sort of grey area of where things are uncomfortable. They're not uncomfortable. They've got money, they've got time, they've got success, but they feel like they've got more, but they're not quite getting that extra level out themselves. And then you get other people who are maybe need some serious help. So there's a huge diverse demographic in that sense. But again, the challenges and the problems that guys of a certain age face are quite similar in a lot of ways. Yeah.
What's your Instagram handle so people listening can head that direction?
My Instagram handle is The Lindsay Bruce. So just the word the, then followed by my name, the Lindsay Bruce. And then my link tree's got all my links on it for the application and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, it's pretty straightforward.
Definitely recommend all listeners or watchers, you can view this on YouTube as well, but definitely head in that direction. I don't have to get involved in the future, if that's all right. I'm a father now, and there's so many things that I want to teach my boy. I'm very much of that, those who can't teach. And I think I'm probably quite a good teacher. I'm not very good at certain things. So I want to do a load of experiences, and hopefully with him, to impart a lot of, you know, the development of mindset, teamwork, community, chasing physical challenges, you know, just challenging yourself. And I think, you know, your community is definitely something I want to get involved in a little bit. So if that's okay.
Awesome. I mean, on that note as well, Phil, this is one of the things I've thought about a lot recently is that, coaching men over 40 or whatever that demographic is, sometimes they're a bit younger than that, obviously, but that's a kind of a staple requirement, because I think that it's going to maybe deter a lot of 20-year-olds from coming up and not being fit for that program. But at the same time, what I am thinking about now is in the future, there has to be another layer to this. So there has to be, the thought process behind this is, why wait till guys are 40? Why not intercept early in their life and create a better existence for these guys before they get to a certain stage in life, rather than wait till they're over 40, so that you're undoing a lot of problems? Does that make sense? So rather than fix problems, why not just prevent in the first place?
Mate, thank you so much for coming on. I really enjoyed that. That was great to talk about it, because I've really reflected on, I've read quite a lot about the SAS recently, and it's so good to hear that you say that they're cut from a different cloth and try and understand what that different cloth is. Mm-hmm. Because I don't know, so much which gets put out there, it's all about discipline, it's all about leadership. And I was like, I agree. But still, we're talking about the 0.1% of the 0.1% of the 0.1%. So what does that look like? So it's nice to get a good idea of what it does look like from someone that was the 0.1% of the 0.1%. So, mate, thank you so much for coming on. That was perfect.
No, it's been a pleasure, mate. I really enjoyed it as well. So thanks for having me on.
No, really, thank you. And anyone that's listening that wants to, you know, link up with Lindsay, head to his Instagram page. Definitely check out the Modern Warrior Project. And we might have to do round two at some point, mate, because I enjoyed
that. Yeah, I'd love to. Absolutely. Be great.
Cheers, mate.
Next week, I will be speaking to S&C coach Jamie Scott. We will discuss his ideas on how to improve hyper performance and why time may be the key factor which is limiting us. Make sure you tune in. Before we wrap up, I want to give a shout out and my thanks to my production partner, Cult Media. If you are thinking of launching a podcast or want to grow your audience, head to www.cult.media, that's cult with a K, to get started today.